Well, we started a new series a couple weeks ago, and I told you that it's a series I've been looking to do for a while, and I thought, man, that would be interesting, and then I kind of backed out for whatever different reasons, and then I finally decided I'm going to go through with it. So I went through with it 2 weeks ago and gave you the introduction to this series we'll probably be on for a couple months now, and it's just simply calling it the seven deadly sins. And that may sound a little negative, as we said a couple weeks ago. You know, it's not necessarily the most positive topic, maybe, that we could talk about. But you know what? I think to ignore this and never talk about these things would be catastrophic. We talked about the fact that, you know what, when something is deadly wrong in the physical realm, like this Ebola virus that happened a couple years ago, or the bird flu, or we talked about historically things like influenza epidemic where literally millions of people died, and how the medical industry needs to get on this thing because, you know, it's really tragic if we can't figure out some kind of vaccination, some kind of way to arrest these pandemics. And yet the Bible makes us to understand that sin is even worse of a catastrophe. And I would be doing myself, I think this church, and humanity a disservice if, in the same way we don't try to better understand physical things that are destroying humanity, how much more should we better understand those things that are destroying humanity spiritually? And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to be looking at these seven deadly, and they call them seven deadly sins because they really are looked at as if you can bring down sin, disobedience to God, things that bring pain in our life, can usually be narrowed down to one of these seven. Just a whole multiplication of different vices and habits, addictions, misbehaviors can usually be boiled down to one of these seven. So we're going to start with the list this morning, and the first one we're going to look at is a big one. A huge one, and it's called pride. Now, there's positive pride and there's negative pride, and we're going to start with the negative side of pride, the one that is considered one of the deadly sins. The Bible is chock full of devastating examples of negative pride, and one of probably one that is somewhat popular is of King Nebuchadnezzar. It's found in Daniel chapter 4, for those of you that might want to take a look at this. I'm just going to read a section of that chapter. We're not going to read the whole thing, but I will encourage you to read the entire chapter. It's a great case study on pride and the devastating effects of pride. But we're going to pick it up around verse 28. So Daniel chapter 4, verse 28 is where we're going to look at. And just to kind of give you a little bit of a preface, the way this chapter starts out is this king, Nebuchadnezzar, has this dream. And when he wakes up, he remembers the dream, but it's symbolic in nature. And he doesn't understand what it means. All he knows is that he is really disturbed. And he feels as though there's a meaning within this dream, and he wants to understand it. So he brings in, as a Babylonian pagan king in ancient times, probably often would, he would bring in his magicians and his chanters or his fortune tellers and witches, and trying to get an interpretation, nobody could. So he finally turns to a man that he knows is connected with God of the Hebrew people, Daniel, and he brings him in, and Daniel gives him an interpretation and basically tells him that his kingdom is about to be taken from him because he's claiming it's all based on his abilities and his doing, and he's full of pride, and so God is going to arrest this thing from him by allowing him or taking from him his mental faculties. He actually becomes mentally ill. He goes insane for a period of time. And so Daniel said, I really don't want to have to tell you this, but that's what the dream means. And then we pick it up a little bit later where this actually takes place. What Daniel said, this is what the dream means. Then in verse 28, it says, all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar, the king. 12 months later, after Daniel had given him the interpretation, he was walking on the roof of his royal palace of Babylon, and the king reflected and said, "Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" While the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared sovereignty, or the kingdom is being removed from you, and you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field, with the animals. And you will be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes." You know, the only funny thing about Nebuchadnezzar is probably his name. As the case always is in the Bible, it's not mythology, it's history. Nebuchadnezzar is a known historical figure of ancient history. In fact, he was the king of what many historians believe was an empire. He was a monarch of a level that has really only been accomplished probably at the most by a half a dozen leaders throughout all the known human history that we know. In other words, anywhere that there was known to be people or populace, he was king over it. It's almost like if he found out there was a civilization or a group of people somewhere that he didn't know about, they went over and took it over. He was king over everything. The way he made the capital of Babylon, which would be modern-day Iraq, was kind of made into an ancient New York City. There were what they could make a similarity of ancient skyscrapers, and there was even sort of like a central park that is still to this day considered one of the 7 ancient wonders of the world. There are some ruins of that. It's referred to as Nebuchadnezzar's hanging gardens. And yet he had all of this stuff, all this level of power, and his life falls apart anyway. But in the end, he says he's glad it happened. He's glad it happened, and he praises God in the last verse of the chapter, verse 37. He says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and honor the King of heaven." He's acknowledging the monotheistic God of the Hebrew people. "For all his works," he says, "are true, and his ways are just." And then he ends with this line, "And he is able to humble those who walk in pride." He's able to humble those who walk in pride. See, Nebuchadnezzar understood that there was a spiritual cancer in him. He came to that point. There was something in him that was so bad, that was so dangerous, it was so poisonous, that even the drastic treatment that came upon him, he says, "You know what, man? It was worth it to get that out of my soul." And God saw fit to include this story in the Bible because he wants us to understand how devastating the effects of this particular sin are. We're clearly shown that this spiritual cancer had basically metastasized fully throughout his whole being. By the time you get to verse 30 is where he says, "Isn't this the Babylon that I created myself out of my power and my majesty?" I remember a song that we taught our kids way back in the day. You know, oldest son is 30 years old now. That kind of is that's humbling, you know. But remember our old kids song we used to play? I trouble. Everybody's worried about number one. Me, myself, and I trouble. What are we going to do about this I trouble? That's what Nebuchadnezzar had, man. It was all about me, myself, and I. And God says, it's not about you. We got to get this thing out. You know, last week, I talked about a definition of sin is a radical dislocation of the soul. In other words, the soul should be centered on God. And what sin does is it's a demand of our heart that everything, including God, should revolve around me. Well, what's interesting with pride is a very similar definition. Pride could actually be the instrument that comes into our life that causes our soul to be radically dislocated. It is the device that often sneaks its way, and we're going to talk about that. Sin, we said a little bit, is very subtle. It's not always just glaringly advertising itself. And man, pride is one of the most sneakiest of all the subtlety by which it slithers its way into your life, and you may not even recognize it or realize that it's there, and it brings us to the point where our soul gets dislocated and it gets into our heart, and then we begin, like Nebuchadnezzar, to demand that everything, including God, should revolve around me. And it could even leak into our prayer life. Our prayers are nothing but instructing God to organize things around me to make them more comfortable and more pleasurable. You know, Jesus understood that. He didn't want to go to the cross, and he said, man, I don't want to do this, but you know what, God? Ultimately, you're the Father. You know what's best. Your will be done and not mine. Pride, C.S. Lewis has a little article or a little chapter in Mere Christianity. It's my favorite book of his, and he calls it the great sin. Doesn't just call it, you know, it's one of the big ones. He says it is the big one. He says this, there is no sin which makes a man more unpopular, and no sin which are more unconscious of in ourselves. There's no sin that we become more unconscious of in ourselves than pride. And the more we have it in ourselves, the more we dislike it in others. Again, he refers to it at that point as the great sin, and he says this, he goes, all other sins, this is like classic, early first 20th century English talking, he says, all other sins are mere flea bites compared to this one. Whoa, that's pretty intense. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. So the Bible makes us to understand, he says, I shall be like the Most High. I want to take God's place. Pride leads to every other vice, he says. It's the complete anti-God state of mind. You see, there's other sins that we can be involved in, and there could be a certain aspects of them that are actually not so bad. You know, like even drunkenness can bring us together with other people, right? That can be almost sort of like a unifying camaraderie between friendliness and jokes among drunken people. And even people that are sexually deviant sometimes are still together. But pride always brings enmity and hostility. It brings separation between not only us and other people, but us and God. A lot of you know, last weekend, I was at my, time to get humbled again, ready? My 40th high school reunion. And it was wild. It was almost like a lesson to me how pride relationally builds walls. And humility builds bridges. Man, 40 years ago, there were people that I wouldn't be caught dead in the hallway with. You know what I mean? And there were plenty of people that wouldn't be caught dead in the hallway with me. You know, and everybody had their cliques, and we all had ourselves just completely riddled with this cancer of pride. And, well, you know, you got the star athletes over here, and they have their group. And then you got all the so-called good-looking women over here, and then the not-so-maybe good-looking ones that are humbled over here. And then you got the musicians over here, and everybody's got their own little group, and everybody thinks they're better than everybody else. And Lewis says the problem is with pride is you're so busy looking down your nose at everybody else, you're not able to realize who's ultimately above you. But it's so nice 40 years later. We're all humbled. I mean, the athleticism is gone. I don't care how good you were 40 years ago, you know. You ain't playing football no more. Not very successfully, anyway. The looks are on their way out, and in some cases, yeah, we have to admit that even our minds are on the way out. That's my famous, you know, high school reunion line, right? At the 40th, we wear our senior pictures so people know who the heck you are. But by the 50th or 60th reunion, you wear it so you know who you are. I mean, it's humbling, but it was great. I mean, I was talking to everybody. People, you know, one kid, and you talk about being humbled, he was, you know, one of the geeky kids, and I never really, I knew who he was, because what was cool is I was in the same school system for all 14 years. And 14, because my first year in kindergarten, as you famously know, I failed. So I took 2 years of kindergarten. Didn't build the blocks right. I don't know, the cray, something. But I had girls and guys I was in school for 14 years together with. That was awesome. And there we are, all of a sudden, like, all the walls are down, man. We're humble and we're... Some people are talking to people that they would have never fathomed talking to. And I remember this one kid, Teddy Brisbane. And he had been in my elementary all the way through. But, you know, he was always a little more geeky. And I was going to say he's smarter than me, but that would pretty much go for anybody in the school. But and so when we got in high school, I really had nothing to do with him. And here we are sitting at a table, and I'm having a great time talking to him. I realize he's a Christian. I says, wait a minute. I says, were you a Christian back in high school? He goes, yeah. I said, really? I says, man, I was so clueless in high school. I mean, really clueless. And he goes, yeah, I know. Thanks, brother. But then you know what he said? He goes, I was praying for you and David all the time, man. I said, really? And me and David are sitting right here. We're both pastors. Hey, don't diminish what Kathy Butler's talking about. Don't you ever believe for a second that prayer doesn't do something. Thank God somebody was praying for me. Thank God Kathy was praying for somebody. Who's going to pray for a Muslim person to come to faith in Jesus Christ? Their parents? I don't think so. Thank God somebody took the burden on. I don't know. Somehow God placed this burden on this kid Teddy's life, and he's praying for me. And God humbled me. You know, it was really cool. They asked me to pray for the class before we ate. That was so cool, and you know, we can all just lay down our pride. You know, I gave him my other famous line, you know. Yeah, you guys all knew me as the drummer, right? Big fish, little pond. Well, I went out to the big pond in New York, headed out to be a rock star, and here I am back as a small church pastor. God's got a sense of humor, boy. It's just so amazing. So I just want to look at a couple things that I think we need to be aware of the devastating effects of pride when it sneaks its way into our life. First of all, this might sound a little harsh, a little abrasive, but it's true, and it really just comes out of the Bible. Pride makes us fools. You know why? Because, well, first of all, that might seem like a strong word, fool, but the Bible uses that word all the time. In Psalm 14, it says, a fool is defined by somebody who doesn't believe in God. You've heard that, right? The fool is set in his heart, there is no God. But the Proverbs are constantly telling us that a fool is somebody that refuses wisdom, who lacks godly wisdom. And you know what? Pride keeps you from gaining wisdom. You know why? Because you're always self-justifying. You can't receive any correction. You're constantly self-justifying yourself. You have a proud heart. You know, a relationship breaks up. This one, you've had a fallout with this friend. You had a fallout with that one. Even at work, you ended up being dismissed. You don't have a job anymore. And then what do? We self-justify. Well, it was her fault. It was their fault. It was the job's fault. And it's the circumstances. And we never learn. See, pride loves windows. It's always looking through the window and pointing at something else being the reason why I am in a circumstance that is uncomfortable, that seems unfair. But humility always is taken out a mirror. And even if it's not totally my fault, God, I don't have control of other people, but I have control of myself. Where are some of the problems and the faults, even if it's not totally mine, that I could learn something from this? I want to change. I want to be more like you. When you're always justifying yourself, you can't learn. Nebuchadnezzar was warned. Daniel comes in. He says, Neb, man, I'll tell you what the dream means. You're getting full of pride. And he gives him a warning. He says in verse 27, he says, listen, king, I hope my advice is going to be pleasing to you. But either way, I got to tell you. I got to break it to you now. That you would break away from your sins by doing righteousness, he says, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there be a prolonging of your prosperity. So he's got the warning, and he knows, he's been told clearly that you're not giving God the credit. You need to repent. You need to understand who's really in charge. It's not really you. You've got some amazing blessings here, but you need to remind yourself who's in charge of the blessings. And how much time did God give him to think this over? Wasn't 12 weeks. Wasn't even 12 anything. See, I was supposed to start with days. That would have sounded better. It wasn't just 12 hours. It wasn't just 12 days. It wasn't just 12 weeks. It was 12 months. If you look at the very next verse, remember, that's where I started reading. 12 months later. And right after it says it's 12 months later, what does he say? He starts talking about how, look at the great Babylon that I have built. Look at what I have done. Wow. And you know what? The James says that God gives grace to the humble, but resists the proud. We have to ask ourselves, do I want God's resistance or do I want God's grace? Lord, help me to learn. Help me to look in the mirror. Help me to, by your grace, look objectively at myself. You're going to need God's help. You do it yourself, it'll be disastrous. You've got to invite God. And often, you'll need a Daniel in your life. Now, I don't know how God's going to bring a Daniel in your life. It could be an actual person. It could be a circumstance. But that we'd recognize it for what it is when God brings it into our life. Because otherwise, pride will just make us into a fool. Secondly, pride claims to be the author of what really is a gift. See, all this stuff was gift for Nebuchadnezzar, but he claimed it as the author of it. Nebuchadnezzar says, I'm the author of this stuff. You know, one way I heard this put, Tim Keller calls it cosmic plagiarism. That's kind of a cool word. In other words, what he's saying is, what if I happened across a piece of music that somebody had written, this incredible symphony, scored it all out for the violins, the cellos, the whole orchestra, and it's an original piece on the level of maybe Beethoven's Fifth or something. And I took that thing and I put my name on it, right? And then I take it to somebody who can really read the thing and say, hey, take a look at this. you know, a person looks at it, they go through it, and they're like, wow, Pastor Greg. I mean, I not only can you preach, man, you can compose. That's incredible. You are such a multi-talented, gifted person. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. How upset would the person who actually wrote that piece of music be? And what the Bible is trying to get us to understand is we may not be plagiarizing in this realm, but are we cosmic plagiarists? Oh, what do you mean? I worked hard for this. Don't tell me that. Yeah, and where'd you get the stuff to work hard for and with? Sure, you might have been able to develop a gift. You practiced hard. You worked hard. But you know what? I'll tell you right now, we talked about visiting Bob Clement. You know that line I say? Often we think we serve because the people need our service. But what is really most important is what happens to you when you serve. You go in and you see Bob. And you visit him. And he'll tell you, you just never know. I know Bob would never tell you this since he's not here today. I'm going to just go ahead and tell you. Did you know that Bob just missed being on the 1964 high hurdle Olympic team? Did you know he ran marathons that were barely over 6 minute miles? Now he's learning how to walk again. People, you just took a breath. It's only God's grace that our lungs have allowed us to take the next breath. Do you understand everything is a gift? Bob would tell you that. I try to when I go visit people in the hospital because it's tough. You know, I'm like, God, I don't want to have to get a stroke to understand anything. And please, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that's what happened to Bob by any stretch of the imagination. But man, there is a glaring lesson for all of us that we are not guaranteed anything. It's all a gift. We're all got entitlement attitudes. And something happens, it's like, well, what do, you know, I don't deserve this. Oh, really? The Bible makes me to understand I deserve the cross. And Jesus says, Greg, you deserve the cross, but I'm going to take it for you, man. So everything is a gift. I try to have that attitude without tragedy having to teach me the lesson the same way it had to teach Nebuchadnezzar. And I go to visit somebody in the hospital. I've told some of you this. Before I walk out of the hospital, I try to say to myself, God, please help me to appreciate the fact that I'm doing something that there is a whole building of people that desperately want to be able to do what I'm doing right now. I'm walking out of here. It's all a gift. We want to take the credit, the claims of authorship, cosmic plagiarism for the stuff we have no right. Thirdly, and this is a huge one, I'm going to kind of sum it up here with this one. And this is one I've mentioned it a little bit, but I want to just look at it a little more. Pride hides itself. It's so crafty. It's like the carbon monoxide of sin, man. Right? You can just be in your house. You've heard of that. People didn't know. They didn't have a carbon monoxide detector. And they just got put to sleep permanently in the middle of the night. They've got nothing detecting it. And it's almost like we need God to give us a pride detector. You know? Don't go there. Listen, it's, I don't want to over-talk this, but I'm just going to mention it again. It's humbling at times being a small church pastor. I'm determined one day that somehow we could put together a conference where the only people that speak are small church pastors, because that's what most churches are. But what do? They take all the guys that got the mega churches that are 5,000 and up. You know, I think churches that size are something like less than 5%, but those are the only ones that talk. Makes the rest of us feel like, sheesh, you know. But then I'm thinking, is that God or my ego? Is that my pride? Man, I better get this together because God's going to shrink it down to me and my wife if I don't let him deal with my pride soon, right? But I tell you what, God spoke this word to me, gosh, it's almost 4 years ago, and I still remind myself of it. I've told you it before, but let me just say it again. I remember clearly just praying and asking God, deliver me. God, it's not about me. It's not about numbers. Listen, we're called to be faithful and also fruitful, but ultimately the end results are in your hands, God. And God, I felt like was saying, listen, can you serve the 50 or 60 people that I've given you with a sense of honor instead of a sense of defeat? It's all a gift. Believe it or not, you guys are a gift. Now, ready for this? Believe it or not, I'm a gift. We're all gifts. Everything's a gift. We thank God for it. You know, what it is with pride, it sneaks in. We don't even see it. I have to pray, God, let me speak that I'm concerned for people's souls and not just trying to look good up here and sound good. That's tough, man. You know, you get all nervous and it's like, well, am I nervous because of my pride? Because I want to, hey, what a great speaker, you know? Or am I up here because I am concerned about the well-being of people's souls? What is the deal with that? And it's always a challenge every single week to be, you see, the thing is with pride, it sneaks in. There's other sins, you know you're doing them when you commit them, right? I mean, nobody commits adultery and be like, oh, wait a minute, you're not my wife. You know, it's like, you know what you're doing. You know, it's not like we steal, you know, and we embezzle money, and then one day we're like, oh, geez, how'd I get that extra $300,000 in the bank account? You know what I mean? It's like, I didn't think I made that much. We know it's a conscious decision. We know when we're sinning. The thing is with pride, man, it just sneaks in there. It's like even disguises itself sometimes as religion. See, the thing is that we can be like, man, I got to get closer to God. You know, I got to pray more. I got to get rid of the lying. I'm going to get rid of the stealing. I'm going to get rid of this adulterous relationship. And you know what? Through your religious self-efforts, you just might kill some of that sin. But guess what? You'll be proud of it. You'll have a religious self-centered pride that you did the whole thing. See, what the devil does is he gets rid of your headache and replaces it with cancer. You want to say something? Yeah, come on up.
This is a little bit personal for me, so if I start crying, don't make fun of me. It's funny that Tara's not here. I can kind of, she'd love to hear this. anyway, so a year and a half ago, I started cycling, and it's become very, very, very important to me. And in some ways, it's been a way for me to take my pride and put it into a thing. And my wife's been telling me I've been very much obsessed with it, compulsed by it, and different things. And I've tried to balance family and cycling. And for those of you who don't cycle, probably don't have an understanding. Jimmy can certainly, you know, relate. I'm wearing the t-shirt today just for you guys. But so the last, probably ever since I did this big 100-mile road race and came in the top, like whatever, the top 10% of the people who started, I've been very focused and driven. And I kept using those words to Tara. I'm just focused and driven, and I'm trying to balance this, you know, my time with this thing and my family. And I've been praying and spending some time trying to, in my flesh, balance the two. And so I go out on a big ride yesterday. We did 50 miles. We did Bear Mountain and did a lot of climbing. And about mile 20, I pull up to a group of cyclists, and bikes are on the ground. And I see a couple of them in the woods. And so I'm like, all right, you know, I'm a nurse. You know, I've worked trauma. You know, let me see if I can help them out. So I ask, is everything okay? Then I see in the woods, I see people going. I said, oh crap, but I didn't say crap. And I said, I'm a trauma nurse. Do you need help? And they're doing compressions on a lifeless body. That guy was Filipino and about 50 years old. And so I start doing compressions on him, and paramedics weren't there. It was just a bunch of cyclists on the phone with 911. And so I'm doing compressions on this guy, and I'm not going to get graphic, but it was clear that he had a brain injury and was not going to make it. And so I'm sitting there, and I've done compressions on countless people, many people in my career, but this one hit home. That could have been me. That could have been my friend Phil and Alex that I was cycling with. That day, it could have been me on Phil's chest. And just when Pastor Greg said, you just took a breath, that's God's gift. It's like, I've been so focused on building power. That's what we call it in cycling. We build power, you know, watts per kilo. And I've been focused on building power. And it's a dead end. It's like I just keep going and stopping. And like, there's nothing, like, if I build all this power and then slip and fall and hit my head on a rock, all that power that I spent years cultivating and building, spending time, it's like, and all of that for what? So I could stand on a podium, get a medal, and then the next day go back to build more power. Like, it's like, I've been focused on myself and what I want to fulfill my fleshly, build my own Babylon. That's what I've been trying to do. So for me, that just stuck out and just like, we could spend so much time focusing on what we want and so much time trying to build our own little Babylon. It's not Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, but whether it's the money Babylon, whether it's the cycling Babylon, whether it's the appearance Babylon in our culture, and I know for me personally, I've fallen into it. We're so like focused on fitness, the way we look, our bodies, our clothing, and especially in New York, like the fashion mecca of the world, it's its own Babylon. So we, in my generation especially, with social media, just so fixated on our appearance and stuff. And I was thinking too, I was reading in Leviticus yesterday, and God gave, you know, the Levitical law to the Israelites, and he said, when you go into the land that I'm going to give you, don't do what those people in, I forget what the exact land is, the Amorites, the Jebusites, and don't do what they do. And they believed in human sacrifice and all these different, like, immoral things. And I'm thinking, I'm like, what's the difference? Like, if Cameron came in here and I threw her body in the fire and sacrificed it, like, how is that any different than abortion? How is that any different than what we already do? We're just a little bit more finagling with it, and we just get it done before they come out. We live in Babylon. We live in this culture, and it takes a lot of work for us to not do that. I've tried doing it in my own strength for the past 3 months, trying to balance my pride with my family, and it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. The only thing that I can do is relinquish control and say, God, it's up to you. If I never ride my bike again, that's okay. If I, you know, I'm dressed in rags for the rest of my life, like, that's okay. I don't have to be worried about my appearance or me. So today is a gift. Whatever you have is not from your hand, it's from God's. He could have created all of us without legs. He could have created all of us with a handicap. He could have created us however he wanted to. He chose to create us the way that he chose to create us, for his glory and not for our own. And today, right now, this breath is a gift. And I have that unique experience of having that yesterday to kind of be a reality check for me. But let that experience, let that man who fell off of his bike and isn't going home, let that be a lesson to you. The same way God taught me, and this is a poignant message for me. Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you. I think that's a perfect segue to go to the Lord's table. You know, the thing is with sin, all sin is really us trying to meet legitimate needs. God puts needs within us that we have, and sin is trying to meet those legitimate needs through illegitimate means. So what is it that we're after with pride? I want people who I think the world of to think the world of me. I want the praise of the praiseworthy. Why? Because we're all desperate for affirmation. We want to know that our lives matter, that our existence matters. And that's why Jesus says, you know what? You got to come to this table and do this in remembrance of me, because this is where you get your affirmation. When you come here, I want to remind you that you are accepted by the only set of eyes that really matter in the entire universe. You are loved by the only heart that really ultimately counts in the end. So much so that he gave his only begotten son to die in place of where we were supposed to die. See, it was his body broken instead of mine. I deserve death, but Christ took it upon himself. It was his blood shed instead of your blood. Christianity is like the perfect balance. Think about it. Humility and positive pride. Humility, it's pretty humbling to have to admit that my sin is so bad it cost Jesus Christ his life. But at the same time, we also see that he valued us so much that he deemed us worth dying for. That's the positive pride. I can be proud in that not just who I am, but because of whose I am. So maybe